It's now April 14th, 1994, and we're going to continue our conversation. And just in case we didn't get this on, we think that the Hoffa trial was in 1964 and that the March on the Pentagon would have come a little bit later than that, maybe 1967, but we haven't checked our books yet. And so now you're going to move on to what happened next.
Well, then it goes without saying the all the publicity that the March on the Pentagon got, and I think we covered that pretty much. So from there, then I was sent, I did not return to my home. I was sent to Boston, Massachusetts area, on a witness protection program. To give you a little background, briefly, the Department of Justice, which the United States Marshal Service is a branch of, came to an agreement that, with other federal agencies, that in order to, and I know they don't like to use this word mafia, but organized crime organizations that were set up within the Justice Department and could get witnesses maybe to testify with a promise of protection and so forth. And it fell on the United States Marshals, or the Marshals were selected to furnish the protection for individuals that were willing to give testimony against organized crime and with a promise of protection. So there was a section set up within the United States Marshal's headquarters that dealt strictly with these witnesses. This particular case was very interesting, and it was, I'll have to go back a little bit and give, as I understand it, the person that was willing to testify against the New England Mafia was a fellow by the name of Joe Barboza. They call him the Mad Dog. And Barboza was a loan shark in Brockton, Mass., or there in the Boston area. And he was not a member of organized crime, but he carried out contracts, so he testified, for the organized crime or mafia people. He had gotten caught for, I think, a gun charge or something, and was serving some time in the state penitentiary in Massachusetts. The Federal Bureau of Investigation had tapped the head of the New England Mafia phones and had taped some conversation where, and I think the head of the New England Mafia was Patriarcha, had put out a contract on Barboza. They had used him as much as they wanted, and they were, I think, concerned that he might begin to talk, and so they put a contract out on him. So the Bureau went to the penitentiary, played the tape to Barboza, and then made the commitment to him that if he was willing to testify and give information on what he knew about organized crime in the New England area, that they would furnish him protection, which he and his wife and child. After playing this tape, then Barboza realized that, you know, this was his best bet. According to the agent that I talked to, the FBI, that he just went totally wild when this tape was played to him, which he was, I'll get in a little bit later, could be a wild, very wild person. They got him out of the penitentiary then and put him in the witness program. And so I was sent up to work on what we referred to as a detail. Samuel Dash was the United States Attorney at the time in Boston. He and I could not think of Harrington's first name, but I think he was one of his assistants, which later I don't recall, but anyway, he stayed with the justice, moved on up in the ranks, but Dash was there. Now, later on, I had a meeting with Dash several years later on the John Dean and the Nixon thing, so he was the lead investigator on the Senate Investigating Committee on the Nixon Watergate. But anyway, they would come out. We went up and had Barbosa in custody. And to safekeep him, we found an island off of the coast of the little community, fishing community of Gloucester, Massachusetts. This island was under the control of the Coast Guard. There were two lighthouses on the island and two houses. The Coast Guard kept a person in. One lighthouse was active and the other one was inactive. The Coast Guard kept one or two Coast Guardmen on the island 24 hours a day around year round. And so we moved the witness and his family out on this island, put them in the one house, which was joining. The two houses were joined. We had about 12, I think, U.S. Marshals then that we housed in the other house. We kept outside guards around the island and trying to keep it quiet as to where he was. And then we depended on the Coast Guard on transporting us out to the island back and forth for groceries and whatever. We did our own cooking and this sort of thing. Now,
were these houses attached to the lighthouses? Were they part of it or were they separate?
No, they were separate from the lighthouses. And to say there was two lighthouses on the island and, I don't know, maybe 300 yards apart or something, and one was still active. We kept one marshal in the top of that lighthouse 24 hours a day. We went in, I don't know, we would go out, I would go out there for 2 or 3 weeks at a time and stay on that island. And then I would come home, and then I would go maybe for 2 weeks, and then I would go back for another 3 or 4 weeks. So this went on for several months, and when it got closer to court time, where Barbosa was going to have to testify in court, which the first court action was federal, was state court. We were trying to find some place inland where we could have the witness and make it a little bit easier in getting him downtown Boston to testify. We found this beautiful compound. It sounds, I have never been to Kennedy compound, but it's in hearing the description of it, this one looked a lot like it. There were two houses right on the edge of the water. You could sort of sit in the living room and fish from it, really. The water was that close to the house. They had the swimming pool. It had the court. The houses joined, but separate. There was a courtyard in between the houses, and it was beautiful. It was for sale, and the government had leased it from the owner for several thousand dollars a month, I think, to keep this witness there. So we went in and set up, get off a coal in the wintertime there. And so we had little guard shacks, top shacks built in four corners of the house. Well, you're always concerned, and on a security mission, you look at every possibility, and one of the possibilities, of course, with this house being two-thirds surrounded by water, that they could maybe get to it by boat, and also by air. And on these things, as most things, rumor flies, and if the FBI or any other federal agency, and I think they got this after they got criticized so much over the Kennedy assassination in Texas, that the FBI supposedly knew where Oswald was and knew that he was a potential threat, or with his background. But they had not passed that information on to the Secret Service. So the Secret Service did not realize, or they normally, it's a different story, but I've been through their program, so any person that is a threat to the President of the United States, they try to keep track of, and they watch them wherever they go. But anyway, rumors usually fly, or the FBI or other agencies, if they hear something from some informant, it may be true and it may not, but when you're talking about that kind of money put on someone's head, you have to presume that somebody's going to try to collect that money if possible. So anyway, we were concerned about the air, and we were concerned about the water. There was only one way to get in by land, and a little dirt road that went back to this compound. So we put out guard shacks on each corner of the house. Two of them on the backside was overlooking the water. And you'd have to realize in that area that boats, fishing boats, pleasure boats, sailboats are just constantly and all over the place. And so we had to keep a pretty sharp eye on that. We set out trip wires out into the woods and this sort of thing. Some things we homemade ourselves by putting gravel and rock in tin cans and tying to a thin wire so we could hear a rattle. Well, that was a good idea, except some animals would hit the wire and run us crazy if it happened to be a dog or a rabbit or something come through and trip a flare. But anyway, we felt that did give us some security. And we did all of the witness shopping for him. Of course, we laughed about him because he had two or three cats. And the government was paying the bill, and this guy didn't eat anything except the best. And the cats didn't eat anything except the best. I have seen him feed lobster to the cats, so there wasn't anything out of his pocket. He was a total wild individual. He had an awful high temper. He would get mad at just a drop of the hat over something that didn't mean anything. You do get awful close to these people, and I spent an awful lot of time playing hearts with him, two or three of us. And Steve Meilinger was a Deputy United States Marshal out of Lexington, and Meilinger may mean something to you, may not, but he was out of Pennsylvania and he came to Kentucky on a scholarship, played football, and became an All-American at UK.
What was his name again?
Meilinger, Steve Meilinger. He played pro ball for Green Bay and Pittsburgh and Washington, and then became a deputy United States Marshal. But anyway, Meilinger was on the detailed same time I was this particular time, and we were playing hearts with Barbosa, and we'd play penny a point. And, you know, nobody ever lost $2 or $3 at the most. And, but anyway, Meilinger was, in the game of hearts, if you're not familiar with it, is you try to keep away from the big count. And I think, as I recall, the queen of hearts maybe was a high point or something. So Meilinger had the opportunity to slap the queen of hearts or whatever the card was on Barbosa. And so when Barbosa played, then Meilinger said, "Let's play like the mafia's playing. Let's get Barbosa." And he threw that card down, and Barbosa started foaming at the mouth. And he jumped up at the table, turned over, and took off back towards his house. Well, Steve Meilinger, as I say, was an All-American. He's about 6'5" and weighed about 230-240 pounds and had fists like a ham of meat. And Barbosa wasn't about to fool with him. But anyway, that was just some of the funny things that went on. And he'd come back and we'd play hearts again. And, you know, he'd get mad and run off. And he had a German Shepherd dog that he wanted to train. He totally ruined that dog. He would try to train him and the dog would get mad and snap at him. I saw him pick that dog up and bite its nose and damn near bite its nose off. He had that dog so scared that when he hollered at him, the dog would urinate. I mean, he ruined a thoroughbred German Shepherd dog. And that dog was so scared of him that it is unbelievable. And a lot of people were scared of Barbosa, not just dogs. So anyway, the court time came. This went on several months, and I was in and out. Court time came from testifying state court. And we were trying to figure out how we were going to get Barbosa into the court, get him out security-wise. So we came up with the idea to fly him in by helicopter into Boston. We would have a mail truck at the heliport. We'd put Barbosa and myself and two or three other people in the back of the mail truck, and we would take him in downtown Boston and into the courthouse. We were going to take him in the day before and put him in jail, with the jail and the courts were located in the same building. But he flat refused to go because he, unless Marshall stayed in the jail with him, because he knew a lot of the local law enforcement and who was on the take and who wasn't, and he just didn't trust anyone at all except the Marshals. So there was three of us then that went into jail with him. And we stayed in the cell. I don't recall, 2 or 3 days, I think, in the jail. We would not let the jail furnish him his food, nor would he have eaten it if they had him. Of course, we did not eat, so one of us would go out and carry meals in to the jail, and we would eat jail. So time came for him to testify. And at that time, and I'm sure it still is, in the New England area, particularly Boston, it's the old English courts where the defendants sit in a box in the center of the courtroom. So you never have any problem identifying who the defendants are. And Patriarca and about four other guys were defendants in this case. And I went in with Barbosa and sat next to the witness stand while he was testifying. They kept giving the old kiss of death sign to him, and he would lose his temper and give it back. And the kiss of death is using the thumb and behind the front teeth and flipping it at an individual, and that's called their kiss of death. Barbosa testified for several days, and on the witness stand he admitted being involved in and committing the crimes himself of about 43 murders in the Boston area. A lot of this I had known, that he had told me at night just sitting around talking, that some of the ways that he had gotten rid of people. Some just for punishment that he didn't want to kill, but get their attention. Different ways, and some that they would use the old meat hook and freezers. They would use a baseball bat.
You better spell that one out.
Well, they would take a guy in a big walk-in freezer and hook him up to a meat hook like you've seen in movies or something, and they would just do this to get his attention, let him know they were serious people.
This was not a way to kill him.
No. But on those that to kill, well, he'd done different ways. He'd shot some, he'd bomb some. He would do anything that the mafia wanted. If they wanted some business out of business, he'd burn them down. And his reward was that he would not charge the mafia. It may be willing to pay him $50,000. But he had about a 6 or 8 block area that he loan sharked. And they agreed to leave him alone and let him operate in there with no outside interference from anyone. And in return, he would do them favors by carrying out some of their contracts for them.
But what would he do when he loan sharked? He must have been making money.
He claimed he was making $12,000 a week at the time he got busted, just
on
loan sharking.
With other contracts, or?
No, he would not charge them for their contracts.
What was the loan sharking? How did that make
you
money?
I'd loan you $5 for a week and you pay me back 10. You know, you just double your money.
Okay. Sorry to be slow.
No, that's all right. A loan shark is about a $500 interest. You know, I loan you $10,000 for a month, you pay me back $20. And you better not be late. Or that's when they take you in and hang you to the meat hook and let you know what to expect if this isn't paid. He told a story, and I have no reason not to believe him, that Patriarca had a dry cleaning as a front in the Boston area. And in the back of that dry cleaning shop, he had an aquarium. And he had the meat-eating fish, I can't recall their proper name, in that aquarium. He has taken people in there, and they have stuck their hands in that fish and let the fish chew on them a little while. And that was just to get their attention. You know, the next time it might be your body in there, not just your hand. And people then would go out and get that money some way if they had to rob, steal, or whatever, because they knew they were in trouble. Anyway, on the testifying, Barbosa admitted using baseball bats, you know, just to break a guy's legs, whatever was necessary. If it was really a serious matter and the mafia wanted someone wiped out or the organized crime, then he would wipe them out. If someone else carried out the contract, he would assist them. And in return, they would leave him alone and let him operate his own little business in the Brockton or one of the neighborhoods there in Boston. And he was not scared. I mean, he Patriarcha and his buddy sitting there giving him this kiss of death, and he was looking straight in the eye. He was not worried about him.
Do you know how you spell is it Patriarcha?
Patriarcha. No, I probably have. I have that upstairs, okay. And I did. So anyway, after his court, which was 3 or 4 days, it was time to get him back out of there, get him back out to our secure area. We were concerned about, of course, everyone in...
This is back to the compound as opposed to the island.
Out of the court, out of the court and jail building. It was the old Charles Street Jail, as I recall. I think it's since built a new one. So we came up with the idea that Barboza and I were about the same height. I like to think I'm a little bit better looking than he was, because we were about the same height. He was a little bit heavier. Physically, I don't know whether all men do this or not, but in this line, all men, I think, do, that you immediately judge an individual whether you think you could handle them physically or not, and I think I could have handled Barboza physically. But he was the type of guy that you never win because he would cut your throat at night or shoot you in the back or something. But anyway, we were about the same in height, and Barboza always wore a big old black hat and a field jacket, which we furnished him, an old Army military field jacket. We decided that I would dress as Barboza and come out of the jail, and the marshals would be, I would be in the center as Barboza, and Barboza would be in one of the positions as a marshal.
Where'd you change clothes? In the cell?
In the jail, yeah.
And nobody could see you?
No, there wasn't anybody in the cell area but the marshals and Barboza. We had two cars there, and they put me in one in the back seat with a marshal on each side of me, and one driving and one in the passenger side. And then Barboza got in the lead vehicle, which people watching would have thought he was the marshal and then I was Barboza. And we went like a bat. I had two motorcycle policemen escorting us back to the helicopter pad. The helicopter was waiting on us, and we got in the helicopter. I jumped in the helicopter and ran from the car to the helicopter like I was really concerned. And Barboza moseying around with rifle. You know, he had the rifle. Of course, it's unloaded. No bullets.
Let me ask you about the reasoning. Now, did you do this? I mean, this says he's more valuable than you are. And is this because you gave him his word you were going to protect him, or was there some other thing that you were saving him for?
On any of these things, you know, that's why you're under hazardous duty of retirement, and which means you get an early retirement, 20 years and 50, and you can retire. You're paid for risk, as police are, all law enforcement people are. You have, I don't know whether it's brainwashed or training, but you do what is necessary to protect your subject, whether it's the President of the United States or whether it's a federal judge or whether it's some witness.
So you weren't so much preserving him for further testimony as you simply were protecting the guy that you said you would protect.
That we would protect. The Justice Department had committed, and that we went at these jobs as, you know, we will do what's necessary to protect the individual. And I guess it felt like if someone was going to get shot with a sniper rifle, it better be a marshal than their main witness, you know. I mean, this is true with the president. The Secret Service agent got shot with Reagan. They're trained this, that, you know, your subject is the most important thing, and you put your body in between the subject and anyone hurt. I did this in the with the students going to these schools. You would do what was necessary to protect whoever you're the protectee.
But a president or and a 6-year-old student is a little bit different than a loan shark who has already testified, and that's just
but
why
if
I
you're
ask.
Committed, you know, you're committed. Justice Department's committed. The Marshal Service was committed to this program, and so you did what you felt was necessary. So anyway, we got him back. We got back on the helicopter, got him back out to the compound, and Patriarch and the four other co-defendants were convicted. They served time. Barbosa then, after a few months, of course, they appealed their conviction and this sort of thing. But pending the appeal, I think the courts denied their bond and they went on to jail. Several months then went on that we kept him in that area just in case, in the compound, really. And then they asked if I would run a detail. We were looking for a place to move him in order to complete the program, which was that we would change their names, we would change their entire family, there would be no record. We would get them new birth certificates, new Social Security, driver's license, school records. Everything, the person Barbosa no longer existed when we get through with it. So they asked me if I would run the detail if we moved him to Kentucky area, and I agreed. So we moved him to Fort Knox. While we're at Fort Knox, then we had over in the officers' quarters, which were houses, not the barracks. We had two apartments, or townhouses, I would call them. They have their own separate entrances and exits, nobody above you. Well, actually, we got three. We put Barbosa and his family in the center one. We put marshals on one side and marshals on the other. We did not have outside guards. We would run the detail with about 6 or 8 people. So you'd have 4 marshals living on one side and 4 marshals living on the other. And that no one would know or ever suspect that he was at a place like Fort Knox.
But if the marshals were there, wouldn't that call attention to
well,
this man?
Well, yeah, a lot of people would, you know, living in the area would want to know. Here he was with, had the Caesarean, whatever you call them, Lebanese look. He had long black oily hair, wore sunglasses constantly, had a big black hat. And he was out in the backyard one day, and one of the officers that lived 3 or 4 doors down was talking to him. I don't know what he did, and he told him he was with the civil investigating agency of the military. Now, here was a guy that stuck out like a sore thumb. You take him to the bowling alley, you know, to bowl, or try to keep him something going for him, rather than just sitting at that townhouse all day. And people just stare at him. I mean, he was one of these guys that you look at 3 or 4 to glance back at, you know. He just stood out. So anyway, we set it up to get his name changed. And so we called an attorney down in Paducah. And the attorney happened to be a former United States attorney, Western Kentucky, Bill Sint. And so we told Bill what we needed to do, and so we took him to Paducah, spent the night in the motel with him, and Bill got all the paperwork done, and we got his name changed. And I cannot save my life remember what we changed his name. We asked him to start thinking of some names. And he came up with Wilson. I said, now, Barbosa, anybody that looks like you is not going to get by with the name of Wilson. You got to do better than that. And I cannot save my life remember what name we named. So, but anyway, we got it all done legally. I mean, this was all done before a judge. And, the judge did not know who he was or anything about it, but sent, got the name changed, and we did that. We got him his driver's license and birth certificates, yanked all school records, everything pertaining to him in the Boston area. He just no longer existed. Then we tried to find, we wanted to find him a job. He was a hell of a cook. Now, he could cook. And they liked very spicy type, not a Mexican type food, but a lot of herbs and so forth in their food. And it was very rich, but he could cook. So we contacted our office in San Francisco. And we what happens, we have contact people in every district of the 95 districts in the country. And if we wanted someone to go to Seattle, for instance, can you, and a guy happened to be a fisherman, then we would call Seattle and say, look, we got a guy that's a pretty good fisherman. Can you get him a job on a fishing boat? So anyway, we called San Francisco, and this guy's a cook. He's good. Can you get us something, get him a job, and so forth. So they got him a job on a cook on a Japanese freighter. And so we flew him to San Francisco, relocated him to San Francisco, had our contact out there to get him a house. We flew him out. We went out with him. Got him located, got him in his job. So every once in a while I'd get a card from him, from our office here. And he would send us, you know, from Tokyo or someplace, and one time he sent us one that had a razor blade in it. I don't know whether he got mad at us, wanted us to cut our throat or what. So I sort of kept up with him a little bit, and in all of these conversations, he would tell me how he had gotten rid of people. And he always said the best time to get someone is getting in and out of an automobile or a vehicle, because they are in an awkward position. Even if you're armed, you know, got one in your belt or whatever, you're in a position that you can't get to it that fast. So he always said that was the best time to get one. Back up just a little bit. The one thing that was so main concerned about Barbosa, knew how serious it was. He had an attorney in Boston. The attorney did not know where Barbosa was. No one did. But evidently the mafia didn't think he was telling them the truth, and they bombed his car. Yeah, he lost both legs.
The lawyer's car.
The lawyer's car. So they were wanted Barbosa. There wasn't any, you know, you hear a lot of little rumors, but this was not rumors. This was serious business. So anyway, we got Barbosa. As I say, we'd get cards from him and so forth. And I sort of kept up with him through government agents, which was only what anybody would know could possibly find him. But for some reason, and this is a bad part of the program, to start with, when a kid has started out in crime, running numbers or whatever they may be doing, and this is all they know, you're not going to go in and pick one of these people out and change their name and change all this information and throw them back out in society and expect them to go straight. I mean, it's just not their nature, and they don't know all this stuff. For some reason, Barbosa went back to Massachusetts and was in Springfield, Mass, as I recall. He was by himself and in a car. He came on a roadblock. He had a sawed-off shotgun laying in the back seat. And on the roadblock, the state trooper stopped him and eyed the shotgun. And placed him under arrest. Took him into, I don't know whether it was Springfield, or I think it was Springfield, Massachusetts. But anyway, put him in jail. They tried him and convicted him. And the word got out that it was Barbosa. Sent him back to the penitentiary, and the name of the penitentiary in Massachusetts escapes me. But anyway, he in the penitentiary then, he got in a fight. And they threw him in the hole, which is an isolated cell, locked
up. Solitary.
Solitary confinement. This worse than, in the hole, is worse than solitary. Solitary is just a cell, stay locked up in all time. The hole is usually, you use a bucket for relieving yourself and set you a bucket of water in there, no showers, no anything. But anyway, they threw him in the hole. A couple of other fellas in the institution got in a fight, and they threw them in the hole. So about 2 days in the hole, the other two fellas sent word out that they had some information they felt like people would be interested in, and they would like to talk to someone. So they called them out, and the lieutenant or some officer of the institution